Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As this year comes to an end, we thought we'd put together some of our very favorite segments from the past year. It was our first year for the 21st. Let's take a listen to one now. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Negro Land is an intimate, bracing look at growing up among Chicago's Black elite in the 1950s and 60s. It's a portrait of what author Margot Jefferson calls the third race between white and other Black Americans. The memoir by the Pulitzer Prize-winning cultural critic is now out in paperback. We spoke with her earlier from her home in New York. Margot, welcome to the 21st, and I should say welcome back to Illinois Airwaves.
Thank you. The pleasure.
As with all memoirs, this is such an intensely personal account of your life in the world you call Negro Land. And because of that, I wonder if we can start with about why you wrote this book and why you wrote about the world. Would you mind reading a passage for me?
I'd be glad to. I belong to an earlier generation, that of the 50s and 60s. It's us and our predecessors I want to write of. Most whites knew little about us, only a few cared to know. We were taught that we embodied the best that was known and thought in, and of, Negro life. We were taught to resent the relative lack of attention our achievements garnered. We were taught that we were better than the whites who looked down on us, that we were better than most whites, period, but that this would rarely, if ever, be acknowledged by white people with all their entitlement. Not the entitlement a government provides, but the kind history bestows. This is your birthright, says history. Privilege is provisional. Privilege can be denied, withheld, offered grudgingly, and summarily withdrawn. Entitlement is impervious to the kinds of verbs that modify privilege. Our people have had to work, scrape for privilege, gobble it down when those who would snatch it away weren't looking. Keep a close watch.
That's Margot Jefferson near the beginning of her memoir, Negro Land. And I think we have to start. Everyone I know asks you this at the beginning, but it is because it's the obvious question of the term Negro Land. When did you kind of create that title in your mind?
Well, you know, I made up this term in my head a couple of decades ago. I was an adult and I'd been living in New York for a long time, and like my generation had, you know, gone through Black Power and the women's movement and all this, and I tended to call us Blacks. When I thought back on the world I'd grown up in, at a time when Negro, capitalized, was the chosen and the honored word, the dignified word, I began to just think of this very particular world that was a kind of land, bordered very closely by the white world, within sharing a space with the larger Black world, and yet with boundaries between us and other Blacks as well. So I wanted that sense of a historical period, with a reference to the past that Negro gives, and I wanted that sense of a charged cultural and geographical and political space that land gives. But it popped into my head before I interpreted it quite so definitively.
And, you know, as you say that, I can't help but think I was just a couple of weeks ago in Washington, D.C., and able to go to the National Museum of African American History. And there's so much there's so much that I took away from my day there. But I think the biggest for me was just how much it really provides a fuller narrative of Black people in this country. And there's just so much of the story that is not told or understood or part of our broader historical context as a nation. And I think one of those is also the notion of Black people who were free, Black people who were upper class. And the story that you write about of, say, Dr. Wilson, of the family and a doctor in Cleveland, a Black doctor, in the 1850s, how important do you think it is for us to know that history in context today?
I think it's extremely important to know the variety, the range of Black history. Any time you're dealing with a group that's been oppressed, discriminated against, you're dealing in historical and mythological terms, not you know, only in political. You're dealing with stereotypes, simplifications, broad generalizations that, whether they are meant to do harm or meant to do good, are crude and unsubtle and flatten out. The fact that, you know, you can be oppressed and you still have a very complicated world and life and psyche. So I think, you know, the range, the unexpected, the contradictory elements in our history that go against the received narrative, this is really important.
Well, and as you say that, I'm thinking about your work as a cultural critic for the New York Times. And as you see this sort of the notion of these flat stereotypes, I think that when I'm of the generation of the Cosby Show and the Huxtables and that version of sort of, and in my mind, you know, and also I think I have to say, as someone who grew up in a place in South Florida where there were a lot of Black people, but they weren't necessarily American, that for me as a kid was my notion of what Black America was.
Oh, God, of course. You know, television just, it is the nature of the medium that it will, it does that, you know? It seduces and imposes, you know, these types of American life, however different they are. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, when I watched The Cosby Show as an adult, not as a young thing like you, I would get a strange sense of time travel because I thought, wait a minute, I was living a version of this decades ago.
Well, and that's right, but you were. That was, I wonder if you could describe a little of your childhood growing up in Chicago on the South Side, different parts of the South Side, whether it was Hyde Park or Kenwood or other areas. And your father was a doctor. Your mother was?
My mother, actually, she was a trained social worker, but she was, which was, you know, the very much desirable position for many upper-middle-class women in those days, whatever your race. She was a mother and housewife full-time for most of my childhood. You know, it was one of the interesting things about this Black elite, which calls itself, you know, a Black upper class, a Black aristocracy, it's an haute bourgeoisie. But one of the things about this is this group has often been seen as very rarefied and specialized and almost exotic because of that. And yes, historically, that's true to an extent. But the life day to day, the surface life of any bourgeoisie is in certain ways very ordinary. You have these rituals and conventions of what good behavior is supposed to be, especially for girls in the 50s. You have the educational aspirations. You have the expectations in terms of career and moving forward in the world. Or, again, if you're a girl at that time, making a good marriage after you've gotten your education. Upper middle class life is meant to be a kind of smooth, orderly life. Now, churning within that for the Black world was, you know, all of this charged, racialized stuff. Neighborhoods. You know, we, of course, didn't have the choice of any neighborhood in Chicago to live in. We were busy integrating all-white neighborhoods or being allowed, as in the case of Hyde Park Kenwood, to integrate in small numbers.
Because of your socioeconomic status, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly, based on definitely economic and professional status. So there was that. There was always the drama of what of the middle-class perks were actually available to you, by which I mean which restaurants would serve Negroes, which stores, which department stores you were welcome in or not. The search for schools, public and private schools. This was very, very problematic. My parents decided they wanted to send us to a private school. At that time in Chicago, two of Chicago's, you know, various private schools, two of them were accepting Black students. So, you know, the parents were always making these negotiations. Now, God knows they had the privilege, they had the resources to make those kinds of negotiations, which the larger number of blacks did not. But these kinds of things, this constant interplay of what you had earned the right to by white American terms of privilege and access, and what you were going to have withheld or denied, that drama, that tension was constantly there. And you were also always in some way performing in this larger white world. You knew that people were listening to your speech. They were looking at how you dressed. They were measuring you by generally these stereotypical standards. Or if they were liberal and progressive, they were hoping you would seem as much like them as possible, hence live up to to the claim that you were equal, which meant in those days, again, if you were equal, you seemed as much like a white person as possible.
And when does a child, this is so difficult to think about a child navigating this world. And I wonder, and you write about this, a couple very stark experiences where this comes to kind of the fore for you. But I imagine as a child, this probably wasn't something you were, was it something you were aware of on a day-to-day basis?
You know, absolutely not. The interesting thing, again, or the peculiar thing about race is how it can, racial challenges and barriers, how they can absolutely recede. And you're just living your everyday life. And it was my parents' job, in part, to make sure that we did have a certain kind of carefree existence. But it was also their job to be vigilant and notice, you know, when an ominous racial cloud, you know, showed up on the landscape, and we had to be warned to be prepared. So it was an interesting negotiation, and often those situations, those incidents, those moments when race intruded, in a burdensome or punitive way, really did come as a shock to one part of you, and then another part, as you got older, might say, "Oh, yes, I've stocked that in my memory bank." But you know, is it in my consciousness or is it in my unconscious?
Well, and as you think about that, I'm thinking about stories that you share in the book about your father being pulled over by the police and them saying, "Why are you coming to this neighborhood?" And him saying, "I live in this neighborhood." And then the police saying to your father, "What's in your bag?" And he said, "I'm a doctor. This is my doctor's bag."
Not a story I was told until many years.
That's what I was going to ask about, because I think stories.
That's a good example, right, of my father and mother deciding to protect us from that. And I think why? They did not want us to feel, you know, threatened in our neighborhood, which was becoming, like most neighborhoods integrated by blacks, which was speedily becoming an all-black neighborhood. So in a sense, you know, they were spared, but they clearly made a choice.
And I wonder when you share those stories, because it's always been hard for me when my parents have shared stories, now that I'm an adult, about racism that they've experienced in America. It's just this really gut-wrenching experience for me to hear my father talk about the way that he was treated as an Indian man, you know, when they first moved to the States in the 70s. Is that a tough thing for you to assimilate? I wonder, because it's really tough for me as an adult to hear those stories.
I could not agree more. It's gut-wrenching. It's excruciating. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. Whatever difficulties we have with our parents, if they are essentially decent people, we look up to them. We have looked to them for protection. We're modeling ourselves on them in certain ways. And so to suddenly see them at the mercy of, you know, these ugly forces, you know, is to have that whole structure of protection and a kind of, of protection and almost impermeability struck. It's very shocking. Also, they were protecting us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we weren't supposed to have to take in all those generations of suffering. You know, and maybe we were protecting them too. I think many in my generation, I think many children, if you know your parents have hopes and longings and ambitions for you, particularly with, you know, these kinds of burdens and discriminations threatening you, you want to live up to it, you know, and you want to take care of them. So again, when you see what they've been, how they've been marked and damaged, it throws that whole structure up for grabs. It makes you feel none of you are safe.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Margot Jefferson, author of Negro Land. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. Stay tuned to hear more of this encore edition of the show. Coming up, we'll have more stories and news from across Illinois. This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Margot Jefferson. She's the author of Negro Land, won the 2016 Chicago Tribune Heartland Award for nonfiction. She's a cultural critic. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her cultural criticism and reviews in the New York Times in 1995. She teaches writing at Columbia University. The Chicago native is back in town this weekend to speak at the Chicago Humanities Festival. Negro Land, her memoir, is out and paperback now. Margot, I wonder, as we've been talking about your childhood, about sort of this, you know, there's just all of these different worlds that you're constantly navigating. And I wonder about, as a child, I loved the stories of how much you loved fashion magazines and going to the ballet and how much arts and culture, whether that was white or black, played a role in your upbringing. And what was it like for you as a child to attend all of the different, for example, great ballet performances that you saw in Chicago?
Oh, you know, in this way, being in Chicago in a family that, you know, could do all of this, it was wonderful. My sister wanted to be a dancer. You know, I wanted to be a pianist or an actress. And, you know, we could see everything. Chicago was a major city in that way. Of course, it had the symphony. It had not as good theater then, but it would get better. But every kind of dance troupe came. We saw every great ballet company. We also saw Les Ballets Africains. We saw Spanish dance troupes. Every major play would send either its first cast or a good second cast to Chicago. You know, there was the Art Institute. There was everything. It gave us, that was a place, those were places we always felt we had free and full reign, you know, to dream in, to be present in, and that was thrilling. You know, and that our parents loved that so much. You know, it gives your imagination license, and it gives you a kind of cultural courage, I think.
And I think it does.
Somehow or another, we could really do, and if not do, love whatever we wanted to.
Well, and to that notion of doing,
to our temperament.
Mm-hmm. I wonder though, as especially I'm thinking about this in your time period of when you were so into different fashion magazines or into ballet. I mean, you're not really seeing anything other than a very white standard.
No, and you know, I think that is one of the most treacherous legacies of cultural segregation. That you, one part of you, your imaginative capacities is, you know, you're just going to take in and devour everything, and you know, yes, it's going to be Maria Tallchief, well, she had Indian blood, God love her, you know, some a white actress you adore, but you are somewhere, and again, maybe it's conscious, maybe it's not, it's depending on the conversations in your house, you are registering, of course, that you're not there. You are also registering it because we were getting Ebony magazine, so we were perfectly aware of all the stories, all the fashion models that had no place in the white world, or once in a while, you know, would, if you were Lena Horne or Sammy Davis Jr., would appear in this other world. So, you know, you are simultaneously taking in what may not be or is not permitted. With my sister, this was particularly charged because she really did want to be a ballet dancer. And once again, my intrepid parents, led by my mother, since she was the full-time mother, found one of Chicago's best white ballet teachers. She got her name through a black dancer friend. Denise auditioned for her, and this teacher, Edna McCrae, said, "Your daughter is very talented, and I am happy to be teaching her. I must, however, tell you both," and my sister had to be about, you know, 10, no more than that, "you know, there will not be room, the way society is functioning, for her to be. She will not be taken into a white company. She will have to dance with a company like Catherine Dunham's," which was a wonderful company, but my sister wanted to be a ballet dancer. You know, so for my sister never forgot hearing that in the same conversation in which she was told, "You are very talented and I am happy to have you." So she took that double consciousness into all her dance training. She finally, as a young woman, became a modern dancer. She fell in love with Martha Graham and Donald McHale and ultimately became the director of the Alvin Ailey School. But, you know, modern dance, thank God she fell in love with it, because that was going to have to be her destiny for a fulfilled and fulfilling career.
And it was, we think about that as you mentioned, sort of this whole double consciousness. I mean, you write about your high school experience reading James Baldwin in college then, and in your young adulthood encountering the Black Power movement. How did that really challenge your identity and your way of looking at the world and sort of the way you had been navigating all of these worlds?
Well, the Black Power movement was, you know, in its broadest sense, a huge challenge to the peaceful protest methods of the civil rights movement, also to the goal of racial integration. You know, Black Power was about, you know, Black cultural as well as political power and a kind of, you know, African history going back to, or going forward to, in many ways, you know, a globally African-based and diaspora-based vision of our identity and our history. That was utterly different than the legacies, the traditions of Negroland, which were all pitched and had been for a couple of centuries, with a few exceptions, you know, Marcus Garvey predecessors and such, which was all pitched toward, you know, the equality of integration and, even if it was a separate world, of a separate Black world that in many ways mirrored its white equivalent. So this was a huge challenge. It was a big challenge in terms of class dynamic.
Right, because you were also challenged. Like, it's sort of the classic also part of Negroland, right?
Power movement.
Right, are you Black enough?
You know, they were based in Marxism, essentially, or at least in leftist politics. So, you know, you were supposed to really examine, you know, your position as a privileged person and start challenging that and not take it for granted. That was huge. And that was merging also with new left politics.
And I think about that, and I think about, you know, we started this conversation with you talking about privilege, but then also kind of when you live in Negro land, the responsibility that that places. And I think certainly on men, but particularly on women, right? I mean, the sharpest part of this in the book is when you write about Black women being denied the right to depression and how you grappled with that and suicide. And I can't help but think of how we don't hear this conversation very much, right? I mean,
we don't. And I think the reason is largely, I mean, I think that I would come to think that the privilege, you know, to be melancholic, profoundly neurotic, and possibly suicidal was indeed a privilege. I think the background to that is, as Black women, we had been charged with fighting off the stereotypic legacy of the Black woman as sluttish, wanton, ignorant, unfit to be a mother or to run a family, unfit to be educated, and unfit to be what was the Victorian legacy of an honorable white woman, No, we you know, we weren't gentle or nurturing or any of those things. So we were fighting two constricting and in many ways false and lying legacies, but they were also incompatible. You know? And that was a horrendous burden. Also in the 50s and 60s, you know, please, 50s and early 60s, you know, you're talking about socially enforced, cheerful misogyny. Even privileged women were second-class citizens in every way. The Black Power movement did not alleviate that. It also was very misogynist. And it really would take the women's movement and Black women taking charge of how to make sure that racial consciousness was part of, was joined to feminism. It would take that, you know, to really propel us beyond this unsolvable contradiction and this hideous burden.
I'm speaking with Margot Jefferson. She's the author of a memoir called Negro Land. And Margot, as you say this, I'm thinking about the current Black Lives Matter movement and how much conversation we've seen around how Black women, how much the queer community has played such a role in Black Lives Matter. Do you see that? So do you see sort of a modern, do you really think that has shifted in the way that we see modern?
God.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's huge. Absolutely huge. First of all, queer men and women, but the men were more predominant and in the civil rights movement. Even if you were a Bayard Rustin, you were discriminated against if you were queer. I've already talked about the misogyny, but the misogyny, the homophobia went hand in hand, you know, to see. And then, you know, there was the struggle with feminism and gay rights to make sure, again, that it had a racial analysis, you know, that it was not confined largely to white and even largely white middle class leaders. You know, so to see, you know, these changes made manifest in simultaneous in Black Lives Matter and in many other ways, in interesting political and cultural discourse, it's everywhere. This, people call it intersectionality now, and it's there, and it lives, and it's going to get more and more interesting. It's not going to disappear, and it's a tool for examining complexity and multiple identities, not for flattening or simplifying.
And as you say that, I think it's under the, I was looking through other conversations people have had with you when I was preparing for this, and it kind of amuses me under the, it's under sort of the rubric of all Black people know each other, like assuming that, you know, it's kind of like when people ask me if I know someone who's Indian, when people ask me, people ask you if your family knew Michelle Obama.
Yes, they do. And we didn't. They will sometimes ask if we'd met, you know, if we had met Barack, which we didn't. Actually, Valerie Jarrett is from the world of Negroland. Her parents, my parents, they're all that. But Valerie's younger than I, so I probably met her a few times.
Sure. That said, I wonder, though, what are your thoughts on our first Black president being from Chicago, this modern context of how he's been viewed?
Well, I don't know how much, you know, these days, now that he's gone through two 4-year terms, I don't focus as much on the Chicago aspect. I really don't. He could have come from someplace else. It was fascinating in 2008 that he was this product of a Chicago political system that was, he was part of the progressive end, but also he had to be a real, you know, manipulator and player. It was interesting to me that, you know, Chicago, being so racially entrenched in terms of its Black, its Irish, its, you know, all of its various white and Black politics, that he was an outlier somewhat because he was mixed race. And you may remember in the 2008 election, there were certain groups of Blacks who said, well, he's not really African-American. You know, he's got a white mother and a Kenyan father. And there was a feeling then that Michelle, as, you know, a genuine, I'm putting that in quotes, Black Chicagoan, that she was bestowing a certain kind of racial legitimacy and security onto him. I think that has long, you know, to some extent, dissipated. There are other things to consider in terms of his legacy.
Marco, we just have a minute or two left, but I think all of that brings up a question for me about whiteness. And I think about Ta-Nehisi Coates also wrote about this in Between the World and me, you write about family members of yours who passed, like the uncle who came back and decided to join Negroland and join that world after. Right. But I wonder, that said, I mean, there's so much of that conversation that's sort of a kind of a subtext throughout the book. What does white mean to you?
Well, it depends entirely on context. In a raw, political contest, it can mean, life and death, struggle for power, with whiteness struggling to maintain what I call in the book its unquestioned entitlement. That's the harshest definition. Otherwise, in the cultural realms I function in, it's much more flexible. Whiteness is a legacy, it's a history, but it's starting to question its purity. It used to be synonymous with a longing for or a presumption of a kind of racial and cultural and intellectual, canonical in every way, purity and religious.
And would you say the same thing? Do you think blackness is similar or no?
I think it's asymmetrical. Mm. Whenever you belong to an oppressed, discriminated against minority group, the power navigations are different. But I would say the simpler definitions of blackness that we once had, we can't be separated off. There are all sorts of cultural movements, artifacts that one can call black. But what is black culture? Black culture, in some ways, is whatever any black person is doing. And black culture would include, in certain way, the legacy of blacks who have passed for white.
Mm.
In certain contexts, it becomes very mutable, doesn't it?
Mm, it certainly does.
That's the deal, context switching, being able to understand that.
Yeah, context switching. Well, that's a whole other conversation that I'm afraid we're out of time for.
It is, yes.
But I want to thank you. Margot Jefferson is the author of Negroland. Margot, thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
Oh, thank you. This was an interesting conversation.
Oh, good. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks. Coming up, activist and educator Bill Ayers joins us to talk about his new book, Demand the Impossible, and how we move forward as a country right now. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Stay tuned. This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Bill Ayers is an activist, an educator, and an author. Today, this Veterans Day, he's taking part in a rally with veterans in downtown Chicago. We caught up with him earlier this morning before he went out to downtown to Chicago to talk to him about his new book, Demand the Impossible, and about this moment we're in right now, post-election. Bill Ayers, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for taking time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you, Nyla. It's a pleasure to be here.
Bill, when you were emailing me this week, you said you were struggling to define this moment, and I think at least half of the country is. What are you thinking right now, this Friday after the presidential election?
Well, I'm still feeling a little gutted and a little stunned. But when I say I'm struggling to define this political moment, I think that's my life's work. I've always been struggling to define whatever political moment we're in. But this is a particularly shocking and I think critical political moment, because we have a candidate who was just elected president, who campaigned on building a wall, mass deportation force, banning Muslims, executing the Central Park Five, clamping down on dissent, and on, leading the Paris climate agreement. So we have our work cut out for us. And I think that it's essential that people of goodwill all across the political spectrum find a way to speak truth to power and to rise up in opposition to some of these unconstitutional, illegal, and unjust initiatives that were the kind of generation of his campaign.
And it was, I don't know how you felt about the past 24 hours, but we saw yesterday President Obama welcoming President-elect Trump to the White House. We heard Hillary Clinton's concession speech saying we have to respect the results. It's interesting to me that we're in a moment now where politicians, whether we're talking about President Obama, Secretary Clinton, President-elect Trump, people who ran very divisive campaigns that I think helped create, certainly not just the politicians, there were lots of people who were kind of creating this very bitter divide in this country, are now saying, okay, let's put that all behind us. Let's work together. Do you think it's going to be that simple?
It's not simple at all. And it wouldn't be simple if Hillary Clinton had been elected. The problems are deep and abiding, and the problems go back to the beginning of this country. For me, the central problem is white supremacy and nativism and xenophobia, and that was very much what powered the Trump campaign. And one of the clarifying things to me in terms of trying to figure out what we think and say in this moment have been all the things running around the internet where people are explaining to their daughters, my son explained to his daughters what just happened. And I think that what's clarifying about it is we tell our kids, don't be a bully, and a bully just won. We tell our kids to respect one another, to not be bigots. And so we have our work cut out for us right there in our own families, in our own communities. But I also think that it's the responsibility of President Obama and Secretary Clinton to do exactly what they did, to be gracious, to be sensible, to be to respect the rule of law and the Constitution. But that's not our responsibility. Our responsibility as active citizens is to rise up and speak the truth as we understand it and to do it in a variety of ways. So I think that this is a moment that calls on us all to resist the re-upping of war, to resist the open gate to Wall Street, to resist the destruction of the climate. It's on us. And I don't think anybody that I know looks at this moment and says, oh my gosh, I have to go hide under my couch. No, this is a moment to rise up. And, you know, I saw a wonderful graffiti that had two definitions of fear. One was forget everything and run. And the other was face everything and rise. I go with the second.
There's a quote in your new book. Your new book is called Demand the Impossible. By the way, I should mention to everyone, you're in conversation about this on Sunday at the Chicago Book Expo. You quote someone saying, what would happen if we told the truth about our lives? I wonder, and you say we got to go to the root of this, but I wonder, isn't part of the problem, if half of the country says we were telling our truth and people weren't listening to us, Donald Trump said my truth and that's why he won. Do you think that's part of the problem?
Well, I don't think in a country like this, in a country as diverse and complex and fascinating and endlessly, bottomlessly complex, I don't think you can say there is a single truth. On the other hand, the way that we arrive at the truth is we create a larger and larger public square. And frankly, I used to listen to you and admire your show when you were in Chicago. I'm very excited that you're back in Illinois, because part of how we create a public square is through spaces like this, that is where we do listen to one another and we get in real dialogue, authentic dialogue, not sound bites, not purchased space, but space where we can actually face one another without masks and we can listen with the possibility of being heard, of being changed, but we can speak with the possibility of being heard. And it seems to me that that is what dialogue is all about. And learning how to talk to strangers is very much a part of what we have to all do in this country. And I'm from the left, and I think the left has a big responsibility to organize, to talk to strangers, to find out where we are and to be curious about where we are. And that does not in any way mean that we should trim our sails or cut back on the principles that we believe in. But in a society like ours, where our politics has been bought and sold, where spectacle is more important than accomplishment, it's hugely important that we open up the public space. And that includes your show. It includes independent bookstores. It includes public libraries. It includes the public schools. And we need to have those spaces so that we can actually speak our truths in an honest and open way.
Well, and Bill, I think it's so, as you say this, how do we, I appreciate you saying that we have public squares and spaces. I think that is a really important part of the dialogue. How do we do this on an individual level? How do you, you're Bill Ayers, you encounter people all across the world and have conversations with them. What advice do you have for people, especially as you say, speaking to your friends on the left, what advice do you have for how we start that dialogue with people on opposite sides?
I really do think that talking to strangers is the essence of democracy. And I think that too many people get into their cocoons, and in the modern world, it's fairly easy to do, and ignore the rest of the world and act on prejudices that they have or pre-assumptions that they have without actually any inquiry or any look. I mean, I have dialogues both formally, publicly, as well as informally all the time with people from the widest range of political spectrum. So, for example, I was in the demonstration at the University of Illinois when Donald Trump came to town. I got a ticket so I could go into the venue where he was speaking. This was in the
at
spring,
UIC, mm-hmm.
At University of Illinois Chicago. But I was with the demonstration, and it was the most spirited, fun, interesting demonstration because all the groups had united, you know, the Muslim groups, the undocumented, unafraid groups, the queer groups, all these folks were calling out in solidarity with each other. And we marched over to the venue where the talk was going to take place. And since I had a ticket, I crossed the lines and I went 10 yards away and wearing my Black Lives Matter t-shirt, joined the line to get into the Trump rally. I had the most exciting 2 hours talking to about 20 young people about why they were at the Trump rally and what I stood for and what they stood for. And it was actually very, very interesting. And it became somewhat congenial, not completely, but these were kids, some of them on fire because they just read Ayn Rand, some of them just coming in from the suburbs for the spectacle, and some of them really concerned about some of the issues. This was a spirited discussion. This is what we need to do more of. I happened at a family reunion to go to the Michigan-Wisconsin football game because we were having a family reunion and one of my brothers got tickets. So I went into the stadium, Michigan Stadium, and I was wearing my Colin Kaepernick jersey. And I was sitting with a group of people who were semi-drunk and getting drunker as the day went on. And it started with a lot of hostility with people shouting at me and being weird, and in my view, and it ended 4 hours later with us having an actual discussion about what it means to protest what's going on in this country in terms of Black lives. I think everyone should do that. That's how we should engage on a local, personal level. On a larger level, we have to find ways to resist, not just tactics like into the street, but other things. And we have to find ways to stand up against, for example, the North Dakota Access Pipeline. We have to find ways to stand up in favor of staying in the Paris Agreement, staying engaged in the world. We have to stand up against the war industry. These are things we have to do, and I think they should.
Bill, your new book is called Demand the Impossible. As you say, it's a manifesto for change, something you've spent your life working on. And you use examples of everyone from, I like this, specifically at the beginning, you talk about John Coltrane and Lin-Manuel Miranda as more modern examples of people who saw possibilities, people who pushed boundaries. How are we lacking in that today?
Well, I think one of the things that the modern world does to us, and I think our society does to us, is it makes us feel insignificant and small. And it's very hard sometimes to break out of the framework that's been given to us as just the normal way things are. So we end up debating small issues like how many charter schools to have in Illinois, or we debate small issues like should we be for Obamacare or for a predatory health insurance industry run amok. And those are not the right debates. We should be debating, for example, what would it mean to have free universal health care for all? What would that look like? We should be debating things like what would it mean to have an excellent, well-resourced, outstanding public school in every neighborhood, not in a few neighborhoods, not skimming off a few people. What would it mean? And when I say,
well,
this
you
to
say
people,
you write in your book, what would it look like if we didn't have prisons anymore in this country?
That's correct. What would the world look like? And the interesting thing to me is we find ourselves with our imaginations in many ways shrinking and disappearing. And imagination is essential to being a free person and to being a free people. As Emily Dickinson said, imagination lights the slow fuse of possibility. That's why we have to nourish the imagination. In terms of education, in terms of the public square, we are not free unless we can imagine a different world. And that's what this book is really about. It's about saying, look, why can't we imagine a world without prisons? What would that look like? And it's easier in some ways for Americans to imagine the end of the world because we've seen it in movies than it is to imagine the end of prisons or the end of capitalism. And yet those are the things we have to imagine as well.
I think the tough part of this is people literally don't see the possibility of this, as you're saying. And I think as being, you're an educator, where do you think we need to look back in history for examples of this happening? Can you give us examples of how we have seen this happen in the past?
Absolutely. There are examples from history, but there are also examples from very current events. But let's go back in history. If you were against slavery in 1850, you would have been against the law, the Constitution, the Bible, your parents, your preacher, your friends, your neighbors. But okay, let's all say now today, we're all anti-slavery today. But in 1850, that was not only unimaginable. Slavery propped up the whole economy of the country. The enslaved workers were, in fact, the hugest resource that existed in this country. How could we do away with it? And only a few people thought it was possible in 1850. Of course, the self-liberating runaway African slaves thought it was possible, but some others joined them, and eventually it became a fact. If you read Lincoln's first inaugural address, it's a law and order address. If you read his second inaugural address, it's a call for liberation. What happened in between? What happened was rising from below. So I see again and again, take 100 years ago, Nyla, if you were for a woman's right to vote, you were against the Constitution, the founders, the Bible, your preacher, your parents, and yet some people were. And today, none of us can imagine a world without women being able to vote. But 100 years ago, it wasn't just the reality, it was unimaginable to do it any other way. So even in our own lifetimes, well, I'm much older than you, I'm 72 years old, but even in your short lifetime,
I was going to say,
you've seen, for example, I'm sorry?
I was going to say, yeah, twice as old, but that's okay, keep going.
In any case, you've, in your own lifetime, seen, for example, the rights of gay people, the rights of queer people and lesbians and bisexual people and transgender people transformed this country. And that was unimaginable 10 years ago. What was unimaginable 10 years ago is a reality now. Same-sex marriage is a reality, but it was unimaginable once upon a time. How did it change? It changed because of fire from below. And I emphasize this because even though we're in an election moment, what changes the world is not so much elections. What changes the world is masses of people changing their minds, mobilizing themselves, and demanding that power make those changes. So Lyndon Johnson wasn't part of the Black Freedom Movement, but he passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. FDR wasn't part of the labor movement. These folks acted because of fire from below. And frankly, we're seeing a right-wing movement from below that's pushed Trump into the presidency. And I'm fearful about the Republican majority and Trump as president is going to mean that they're going to move forward because the Republican majority, their positions aren't that much different than Trump. Many of them find Trump unsavory, but they don't disagree on the issues. I think we're in for a world of trouble, and I think we have to stand up.
Bill, we are out of time for my on-air program. Can I ask that you stick around and we'll continue our conversation
sure.
and we'll put it all online?
Sure.
Thanks so much. That's Bill Ayers. Bill, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for listening to The 21st, a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Take care.